From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At the Hadassah hospitals in Jerusalem, Palestinian and Jewish doctors work side by side treating Palestinian and Jewish patients. The patients have included casualties of suicide bombings and casualties of Israeli military actions. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with two of the doctors, Israeli David Zangen and Palestinian Radgund Amir. Also, we talk with Alice Siebold about her new novel, The Lovely Bones. It's probably the most acclaimed novel of the season. The story is about a 14-year-old girl who is raped and murdered, then goes to heaven, from where she observes how her family is changed by her death. Siebold is also the author of a memoir about being raped. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has overwhelmingly approved a bill that would allow commercial pilots to carry guns in the cockpit. The measure would permit any of the nation's 70,000 pilots to carry a firearm aboard their planes if they agreed to undergo training. The bill is opposed by President Bush, and it faces strong opposition in the Senate, where critics say that guns would detract from the pilot's real job of safely operating the plane in an emergency. They say that strengthened cockpit doors and undercover air marshals will ensure greater safety. Vice President Dick Cheney has been named in a lawsuit alleging accounting fraud at the Texas oil service company Halliburton, which he once ran. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Vice President Dick Cheney was chairman and CEO at the company between 1995 and 2000. The legal watchdog group, Judicial Watch, filed the suit on behalf of three Halliburton investors, a husband and wife from New Mexico and an investor from Indiana. In it, the investors say they lost more than $200,000 on their Halliburton stock. They allege Halliburton share prices were distorted by inflated revenue claims coming from the company. According to the suit, between 1999 and 2001, the company overstated revenues by $445 million by claiming fees that had not yet been collected. Halliburton officials, however, say the company followed generally accepted accounting principles. Cheney had no comment on the suit. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said the suit was without merit. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Senators voted overwhelmingly today to increase penalties for securities fraud. The vote came on an amendment to legislation that's designed to reform the accounting industry. The amendment would make securities fraud a felony, subject to a 10-year prison term. All over the world, children and their parents are dying from AIDS at rates that no one could have imagined just a half dozen years ago. That assessment today from child health experts at the World Conference on AIDS in Barcelona. More from NPR's Frank Browning.
The numbers are hard to grasp. Ann Peterson of the U.S. Agency for International Development laid out the worst.
In Africa, 30 million children are orphans. One-third of them are due to AIDS. By 2010, 40 million children will be orphaned, but half will be due to AIDS.
That's 20 million kids whose parents will have died in the epidemic in Africa alone. Moreover, Peterson said, even if the epidemic is brought under control, these millions of uneducated, unsupervised children will likely suffer ongoing stigmatization and sexual exploitation as they seek to survive on the streets. Frank Browning, NPR News, Barcelona.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 282 points, or 3%, to close at 8,813 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 35 points, or 2.5%. This is NPR News. A lawsuit has been filed on behalf of the California teenager who was roughed up by police during a videotaped arrest. A lawyer for Donovan Jackson said the video shows that Jackson's constitutional rights were violated. The tape, which has been widely shown on nationwide television, shows an officer slamming the handcuffed teenager onto a car and punching him in the face. Scientists have discovered an ancient skull in the Sahara Desert that could turn the story of human evolution on its head. The fossils, thought to be 6 or 7 million years old, twice as old as any hominid skull ever found. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The skull has shocked many anthropologists because it looks nothing like what they expected. More recent skulls, like that of the famous Lucy, still resemble chimpanzees in some ways. Their teeth protrude from under a long snout that stretches forward. This skull doesn't have a snout. The face looks flat, like modern humans. The finding has thrown the evolutionary tree for humans into disarray. One anthropologist says the skull belongs to a previously unknown species of ape. It may have been this animal that later evolved into modern humans, relegating other fossils to the status of also-rans. The discovery team was led by French paleontologist Michel Brunet. The report appears in the journal Nature. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
California has declared a Stage 2 electrical emergency as temperatures in the triple digits drive up the demand for air conditioning. Authorities are asking residents and businesses to conserve energy during the peak hours between 3 and 6 p.m. A Stage 2 emergency doesn't authorize power grid managers to impose rolling blackouts, but it does allow them to interrupt power to some users. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The divisions between Israelis and Palestinians are supposed to be irrelevant at the two Hadassah hospitals in Jerusalem, where my two guests work. About 15% of the doctors are Palestinian or Israeli Arabs. The remainder are Jewish. The patients are more evenly divided. They have included casualties of Palestinian suicide bombers and casualties of Israeli military actions. The hospitals were established by Hadassah, the Women's Zionist Organization of America. My guests are Drs. David Zangen and Radgund Amir. Dr. Zangen is Israeli. He's a pediatrician specializing in juvenile diabetes and pediatric endocrinology. He's also the medical officer for his reserve unit in the Israeli military and was the chief medical officer for Israel's military operation in Jenin in April. Dr. Amir is Palestinian. She's a fourth-year resident in ophthalmology at the hospitals. The doctors went to a studio in Jerusalem to record our interview. I asked them how hospital life has changed since the recent suicide bombings and the Israeli incursions into the West Bank and Gaza.
I remember very strongly, 3 weeks before the Defensive Shield operation, sitting in the clinic, and I have the juvenile diabetes clinic in Jerusalem, and opposite me, a very kind, a very nice family who I know, and 7-year-old diabetic child, Palestinian, from East Jerusalem. And then I get a call from my wife, and she tells me, did I have any contact with our children? And my oldest has a cell phone, and I said, no, usually I'm not in contact with them during the day. And she tells me, listen, there is a suicide bomber or suicide killer in the German colony, which is a neighborhood in Jerusalem where my children go to school. And, my wife tells me that she can't get in contact with our children. And here I sit, in the diabetes clinic, and this family looks at me getting this telephone call. And, I'm kind of puzzled in a situation where you are really worried for your children. I have four. And on the meantime, treating a Palestinian patient, and it's a kind of a strange situation. I went on, and fortunately nothing happened, and the guy was caught, and fortunately there were no victims at this episode. But this was kind of a reflection of what you are going through during the everyday.
I feel that although we are physicians after all, but we also share our internal conflicts with the people surrounding us. So even during times where Palestinians are being injured or attacked, or Israel is being also attacked, we also have our emotions that we feel inside of us, but definitely we don't allow these feelings to affect our medical career or our care that we show to the patients, or medical attention, nor our medical decision about our patients.
Dr. Amir, what kind of new injuries are you seeing as a result of either the suicide bombings or the Israeli incursions?
I feel that as an ophthalmologist, the thing that has changed is in the type of the patients that we are receiving during the last, let's say, 1.5 years. We have been seeing more of the penetrating eye injuries, perforations, intraocular foreign bodies. And these have been probably equally seen in both Palestinians and Israelis, as both of them have also been victims.
Are there objects put into the bombs that some suicide bombers use that create difficult-to-treat wounds? Like, I've read that there are, you know, nails and shrapnel put into bombs. Are there other things like that that make it very difficult for you to treat the wounds?
You know, it's not only because of the bombs, because there were also some Palestinian patients who have been treated because they were injured by the army. So we see victims, in fact, of both sides. And this is very unfortunate, because we really suffer when we see innocent civilians suffering as well. I see no value and I see no meaning in just keeping and seeing all the time innocent civilians living peacefully in their homes and going peacefully on the streets, sustaining injuries all the time. So this is, I think, what hurts us also very much.
I'm wondering if either of you have found that your politics have been affected by the medical work that you do, or the kind of solution that you would like to see to the Middle East conflict, if that's been affected by the medical work that you do and by seeing all the wounds that you have to treat.
Well, I believe both of us and everybody as a doctor, and I believe it should be so, that it just strengthens our desire for peace and our desire to prevent any further wounded people, you know, that get wounded from, you know, innocently. I must say that sometimes I'm very worried, and, well, I will tell you, even surprised by doctors, especially, you know, because of their profession, because of their sensitivity and what I expect them to be towards humans, that lead, you know, movements like Hamas. You know, there is Dr. Mahmoud Zahir in the Gaza Strip, who basically encourages suicide attacks. And with that, you know, doctors taking part into the political struggle, but in a way that is really not human, that bothers me.
Dr. Zangen, do you have any mixed feelings about serving with the Israeli military? You're the chief medical officer for your reserve unit,
yes,
and you were the chief medical officer during the Israeli incursion into Jenin. Did you have any mixed feelings about being with a military unit while it was making this incursion into Jenin?
First of all, I'm a father of 4 children, and I belong to my people, and I definitely believe that we had to stop this monstrous suicide murders in our streets.
Dr. Zangen, have you ever treated somebody who turned out to be a suicide bomber or somebody involved with the suicide bombings?
Well, during the operation, I treated also Palestinians. I remember clearly one now, that 22-year-old who had a tattoo of the Hamas movement on his arms. He had a wound in his neck, and as an army reserve doctor, I treated him there. It came to our knowledge during the treatment that he was one of the planning people for the suicide attack on a bat mitzvah, is a celebration of a 12-year-old girl in Hadera, in a celebrating hall, killing some people who came just to celebrate with a girl turning 12 in a hall. And he was the one who organized this suicide murder. And, you know, when you are treating a patient, you are treating him. And he is now wounded, and he is now, you know, has to get the treatment on the spot. Obviously, afterwards, he might be investigated and interrogated and asked about the terrible things that he had planned. But as a doctor, you look at him as a human being and treat him.
Dr. Amir, I'm wondering if there's anyone in your family or within your circle of friends who have been victims of the Israeli incursion or of, you know, the IDF.
Well, not close people, but probably people in the East Jerusalem. As I've told you earlier, mother of three. She has two daughters in the university and one son studying in the U.S. On a Friday afternoon, she was hearing shooting outside the house, and she wanted to protect her daughters who were inside her, so she decided that she would go and close the window of the saloon, and so a bullet hit the window and a piece of metal went into her eye. She had been through four surgeries over her eye, and she had sustained profound loss of vision in that eye. And the stories never end, you know, but I believe that we were mostly to concentrate on the medical aspect here in our work. And the question that you asked previously, I didn't have the chance to answer it. You asked if you think that our medical career affected our decision of how we see the future.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a deep believer that the coexistence is the solution. We are two people living on this land, and I believe that peace is the ultimate solution. And from what we have experienced before the rising of the last Intifada, we have experienced Israelis and Palestinians living together. And I believe that despite all the despair and despite all the frustration that people are feeling these days, still they are hopeful because they still have deep faith in the fact that we can live together peacefully.
My guests are Palestinian Dr. Radgund Amir and Israeli Dr. David Zangen. They work at the Hadassah Hospitals in Jerusalem, which treats Jewish and Palestinian patients. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Israeli Dr. David Zangen and Palestinian Dr. Radgund Amir. They work at the Hadassah Hospitals in Jerusalem, which treat Jewish and Palestinian patients. Let's pick up where we left off. Do politics come up a lot in the hospital, or is that something that the doctors and nurses try to avoid so that you can focus on the medicine and avoid the possibility of political conflict?
Oh, we discuss it here and there. It's not the main issue in the hospital. We have more crucial elements to experience during the hospital. We have enough medical challenges.
You know, politics takes a lot of time.
We
leave it for the politicians. That I would put it in this way. I would maybe add, you know, you talked about the hospital. What happens to you on a personal level? For me, there is an element that, you know, you can't escape. And what is that? Is the chief nurse of the neonatal intensive care unit of Hadassah, Aviva Raziel, is the best nurse I know. You know, one that you can rely on, the one that, you know, will call you in the middle of the night and say, if something is really going bad, it's 100% going bad. And if she is not waking you up, you can be sure that she does, that there is no reason to be worried about the patient. And she, 11 years ago, she lost her husband due to brain cancer. She raised her four daughters, three, she got married, and the last, she was a 16-year-old girl. She was a counselor in the youth movement, and I remember her as a five-year-old during the time when her father passed away, running around in her house. And then when she was 16, she went to the Sbarro Pizza in the center of Jerusalem to buy a pizza. And she died in the suicide attack in the Sbarro Pizza in the center of Jerusalem. And I didn't want to talk about that, but about the, you know, if you ask if you, in the hospital, if you feel it, you know, to pass every day on the corridor with this nurse who never complained after raising alone her four children, always with a smile, always with professional excellence. And then to see her, you know, it's a kind of, you don't know where to put yourself or where to escape. So, you know, it's true. At least on my side, it's not that you discuss it, it's not that you deal with it, but, you know, to see her on the corridor, you can't escape seeing this Aviva and the feeling.
Well, it makes me wonder if there's a kind of chill between the Israeli and Palestinian doctors after an attack or after an Israeli incursion into a Palestinian town, you know, whether in spite of all your best efforts, if there is a chill or is friction.
Well, I don't think so. At least in my department, there is a resident who is Palestinian from Jat, a village called Jat, and he is an excellent resident and is doing fine, and I never felt with him any kind of tension. Moreover, I can tell you that during the operation itself, I was still in contact with some of the, and I'm still now, with the Arab doctors from the West Bank. Even the family that I treat, when they have hyperinsulinism, which is a disease I deal with a lot, and the family from Jenin called me during the operation when I was in Jenin to my cell phone. And, you know, soldiers around heard me speaking in Arabic. I'm not speaking very fluent Arabic, but I can communicate very well. And, well, they had questions about what to do in such and such case, and it was kind of strange, but I never felt any kind of friction, not between doctors and not with the patients, I don't know.
Well, I believe that everyone has his own feelings, and even after each event we do have feelings. But I believe that our medical obligation leads us to the way of managing with each other without allowing this to affect our relation with the colleagues, without allowing this to affect relations with the medical staff or with the patients. Personally, I had the chance of treating both Israeli victims as well as Palestinian victims with my Israeli colleagues, and I believe that it was a very special effort.
Dr. Amer, I'm wondering if you ever feel that you're treated differently in the hospital than you are on the street in Jerusalem, if you feel that you're treated with more respect in the hospital and more suspicion on the street, treated by Israelis that way.
Well, it's a different world inside the hospital. No one can deny that. It's like heaven on earth.
What are some of the differences for you? What's it like on
well,
the street compared to the hospital?
There is no difference between people whatsoever, between medical team whatsoever. There is no difference between doctors. There is no difference between nurses. There is no difference between the patients receiving treatment inside the hospital. But definitely you get to experience the variable and the different indignities on the streets.
What are some of the indignities that you're referring to?
Well, you have constantly being suspected. You're constantly being asked to identify yourself. You're searched all the time. So it's not that easy outside on the streets.
Do you ever have any problem getting to work?
No, but I definitely have three of my colleagues having difficulties in getting to the hospital. Two are living in Ramallah. During the different operations, they have real difficulties in getting to the hospital for long periods, like for more than 3 weeks. And during the regular times, they might be late. They might come like 1 hour later, or they might be like 1.5 hours late. And they definitely have problems in passing the different barriers, since it's not only one barrier, there are a number of barriers that they have to pass through during their work. So this definitely affects their mood, this definitely affects their, I don't know how to explain it to you, it definitely affects their psychological status before coming to work.
Does it show at work? You know, you were talking about how everybody's equal and
no,
politics
isn't
a big issue at work.
Yeah. That's our challenge. It does not.
Mm-hmm. Even though the doctors are very professional and you try to keep politics outside of the hospital, what about the patients? Do patients ever object? Do Jewish patients ever object to a Palestinian doctor? Or Palestinian patients ever object to a Jewish doctor? And do Israeli and Palestinian patients ever get put in the same room and object to that?
Well, I can put it this way. I feel proud of our patients, really, being both Israelis and Palestinians, since their aim is mainly to receive medical care. And it's just wonderful how medicine can bypass all the different views and the different and all the big differences that we have among us. And it's just make you feel like you're dealing with a one single big family inside the hospital. And I think that really medicine can make wonders.
Radgun just reminded me now, you know, on the 11th of June, I have every year we do a kind of a patient conference for juvenile diabetes. And it's already the third year that we have it. This year, we did it in the Israeli Museum, and we invited the Minister of Health to come and to see. During this conference, we gave a kind of update, scientific update of what's going on in the research of diabetes of the last year. And also, it's a kind of a social gathering, because for the diabetic patients, it's very important to see each other, to know that they are not alone struggling with this disease. And basically, you know, you see there the heterogeneic population of Jerusalem. So you could see there Palestinians with the traditional dresses, you know, like about 40% of the people were Palestinians. Some are very extreme Orthodox Jews, you know, with their typical appearance. And some were just, you know, secular Jews, and some secular Arabs. And that was kind of, and the Minister of Health told me, listen, how do you put them all together? Maybe come you and, you know, join politics and, you know, put us all together, that we'll get to peace. But this is a kind of really, it's, I agree with Radgun, being proud in the patients, but being, I'm very much proud in the, you know, the medical personal who doesn't really just gives the treatment as it should be to a human being.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
We would like to thank you as well.
So do I.
Doctors David Zangen and Radgund Almer work at the Hadassah Hospitals in Jerusalem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mother Rocket, a collection of stories by Rita Cerisi, author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Alice Siebold, author of The Lovely Bones, perhaps the most acclaimed novel of the season. It's about a 14-year-old girl who is raped and murdered and then goes to heaven, where she watches her family carry on. Siebold is also the author of a memoir about being raped.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alice Siebold, is the author of the new novel, The Lovely Bones, which was described in Time magazine as the breakout fiction debut of the year. The story is about the rape, murder, and mutilation of a 14-year-old girl and its aftermath. Our own book critic, Maureen Corrigan, said the subject matter made her reluctant to pick up the book, but reading it gave her a singular, disturbing, and even enlightening literary experience. The author, Alice Siebold, also wrote a 1999 memoir about being raped when she was in college. The new novel begins with the attack on the girl. The rest of the novel is narrated from heaven, from where the girl observes her family and friends as they try to carry on after her death. We'll start with a reading from the beginning of the book. The girl has taken a shortcut home from junior high through a cornfield. She meets a neighbor, Mr. Harvey, who forces her to take off her clothes. Before we start, I should tell you that this is a graphic and disturbing account of the attack, which may not be appropriate for children to hear.
"Don't, Mr. Harvey," I managed, and I kept saying that one word a lot, "don't," and I said "please" a lot, too. Franny told me that almost everyone begged "please" before dying. "I want you, Susie," he said. "Please," I said. "Don't," I said. Sometimes I combined them, "please don't," or "don't please." It was like insisting that a key works when it doesn't, or yelling, "I've got it, I've got it, I've got it," as a softball goes sailing over you into the stands. "Please don't." But he grew tired of hearing me plead. He reached into the pocket of my parka and balled up the hat my mother had made me, smashing it into my mouth. The only sound I made after that was the weak tinkling of bells. As he kissed his wet lips down my face and neck and then began to shove his hands up under my shirt, I wept. I began to leave my body. I began to inhabit the air and the silence. I wept and struggled so I would not feel. He ripped open my pants, not having found the invisible zipper my mother had artfully sewn into their side. "Big white panties," he said. I felt huge and bloated. I felt like a sea in which he stood and pissed and shat. I felt the corners of my body were turning in on themselves and out, like in Cat's Cradle, which I played with Lindsay just to make her happy. He started working himself over me. "Susie, Susie," I heard my mother calling. "Dinner is ready." He was inside me. He was grunting. "We're having string beans and lamb." I was the mortar. He was the pestle. "Your brother has a new finger painting, and I made apple crumb cake."
That's Alice Siebold reading from the opening of her new novel, The Lovely Bones. I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering why write about something so horrible, so unthinkable, the rape and dismemberment of a 14-year-old girl.
Because it's part of life. You know, that's the simplest answer, I think, for me. It's very much part of the experience of what it is to live in this culture. It happens all the time.
Now, you were raped yourself when you were a freshman in college, and that's a subject of an earlier book you wrote, a memoir. And reading those two books back to back, I was really struck by the difference in the descriptions of the rape. The rape, as you describe it in your memoir, is very brutal, very detailed in its brutality. It's as if you're reliving every moment and describing it like a journalist.
Mm-hmm. I think they are very different books in my mind, even though they both not only have violence but start out in violence. One of them is factual, and I tell every detail in some way in the memoir. And the other one is a fictive voice, and there's so much more being given in the first chapter of The Lovely Bones in terms of getting to know her character and some of the facts of her family and her background.
I got the impression that the kind of moment-by-moment description of the brutality that's in your memoir is something you felt didn't belong in this new novel, in the description of the brutality that this 14-year-old faces.
Funny thing is that I did write the beginning of The Lovely Bones before I wrote my memoir. So Susie's, the violent crime that occurs in Susie's life happened in terms of writing about it before a description of my own rape was written by me later. I think in order to separate the two stories to make sure that Susie was not doing any of my work for me. When I returned to the novel, I stopped to write Lucky, and one of the things that it was very important for me to do was to get all the facts down of my own case. So they had been written, they existed whole in a whole nother book, and I could go back to Susie and she could lead me where she wanted to take me and tell me her story in the way she wanted to tell it, as opposed to me feeling perhaps that I needed to really tell the real deal about every detail about rape and violence. I did that in the memoir as opposed to the novel, because I wanted my characters to rule the novel, not some sort of desire to talk about rape and reveal rape to readers.
Your memoir ends, "I live in a world where the two truths coexist, where both hell and hope live in the palm of my hand." Is that in a way where your novel picks up with hell and hope, or hell and heaven being side by side?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of my major motivations in terms of how I live my life. And also, though, why I see fiction as so incredibly important is to be able to give, in a very short space, the context for those two things coexisting, and coexisting in an honest way, where hope is really springing out of something that was is hard won, as opposed to purchased in the, you know, how to cope section at the local bookstore.
After Susie is raped and killed and mutilated, and this is in the first chapter, she goes to heaven, and the rest of the story is narrated by her as she experiences this part of heaven and looks down on her family and neighbors as they go on without her. What interested you in this idea of your narrator being in heaven looking down on the people she's had to leave behind?
I think I needed to find a way, and first I have to say that, again, when Susie's voice presented it to me, she presented completely, and she was already in heaven. So that was something, when I got to the end of the first 15 pages, which I did not know was going to be the first chapter of a novel, I had my character, I had where she was, and I had what had happened to her. And because she was such a bossy main character, I had no choice. I had to follow her. So though it was not conscious a choice to place her in heaven, once I realized that she had put me there in some way, it is a position from which she can tell a story to a reader and bring a reader to places that they wouldn't have access on, and that she wouldn't have access on unless she were in heaven. And to see, referring back to the previous question about heaven and hope, or hope and hell, all those things, to see those things put together in a context that is ultimately in some way horrible, but doesn't have to be so threatening that readers are afraid to read about the truth or about the reality that a girl like Susie would experience.
Can you describe the heaven that you've created for Susie?
It's a heaven with what I'd say is a lot of open spaces. It was much more detailed in early drafts of the book, and it was an experience in creating where I wrote much more than ultimately remained. Knowing what to take away so that people can bring their own ideas of things into the heaven that remains. There's something probably strangely like the open fields of suburbia about the heaven that Susie inhabits, because in the book, the heaven would reflect a bit of what the person had experienced or known on Earth. There are also silly things like the textbooks that she has are 17 in vogue, because that, in her case, as a 14-year-old girl, would be a textbook that she'd want to have. And then there are other things that are not, say, fun or familiar, and those are the things to try to figure out how to rectify the situation that she's in and look at the people on Earth and see them really suffering, and how to cope and understand herself with that, as they are coping and understanding with her loss on Earth.
My guest is Alice Siebold, author of the new novel, The Lovely Bones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Alice Siebold is my guest. Her new novel is called The Lovely Bones. She's also the author of an earlier memoir called Lucky, which is about her experiences as a rape victim. In your memoir about being raped, you write, "The burden of being father and mother to a rape victim fell very heavily on my parents." And I'm wondering if that thought informs some of the writing of your novel, because part of the novel is about the after effects of the rape and murder on Susie's family.
Definitely. The experience of violence, particularly a tabooed violence, like a rape in my case, and particularly like a rape and dismemberment in the case of Susie's family in the novel, is one of the most alienating experiences that I think you can have. And for my parents, it proved to be very strange sometimes, even among their close friends, even with people who didn't intentionally mean to say things that were hurtful, for instance, and sometimes hurtful through ignorance, which is not necessarily their fault. And I think definitely that transferred to the idea of Susie's family being extremely alienated in their circumstances.
You write about the burden of guilt on the parents in the novel. Susie says about her father, "Every day he got up, before sleep wore off, he was who he used to be. Then as his consciousness woke, it was as if poison seeped in. At first he couldn't even get up. He lay there under a heavy weight, the guilt on him, the hand of God pressing down on him, saying, 'You were not there when your daughter needed you.'" Do you want to talk a little bit about the guilt you imagine the parents feeling?
It's an interesting thing. Some of the father was another character for me in the novel that was there very quickly, very immediately, and he really, to me, is the heart of the family. I think, particularly with a sexual assault crime, whether the victim is a child, whether it's a male or a female child. Fathers often feel extremely responsible for what happens in that way to their children. They want to be able to fix it very, very much and go out and do something. And it has become somewhat stereotypical in movies and television that the father wants to go and catch or kill the perpetrator. But the truth is that it's a stereotype that reflects reality. In my own experience, I can count the number of times that, both my father, but also boyfriends, male friends, particularly would say things like, you know, "I want to kill the bastard." Just in this desire to do something, and also to great shame because the perpetrator is male. And for the mother in The Lovely Bones, it throws her into a whole reevaluation of what her life has been about. Obviously, there have been problems with her understanding of its value before this, but then in the loss of her daughter, it throws her again into this questioning about what she's done with her life and whether it was actually indeed what she wanted to do with it.
After you were raped, when you were trying to figure out what you were doing with your life and dealing with all the wounds that this rape left you with, psychological and physical, were you at the same time watching your parents dealing with a different set of wounds caused by the same rape?
Definitely, particularly my mother, I think. It just hits the entire family like a ton of bricks. And trauma is, especially when it's a trauma that is not a well-known trauma for those traumas that are well-known, really, there's so much to try to understand. I remember watching television, say, with my sister after the rape, when I was just basically lying on the couch and trying to recover. And if anything came on that made her maybe think about violence or whatever, she would stare back at me, and it made me highly self-conscious. But she was deeply trying to understand what my experience had been. And I think one of my motivations for writing my own book, and certainly also a motivation for writing the novel, is the desire to just put it out there on the table. This is what a rape can look like. And if people maybe know more about it, then the victim's not as alienated, nor is the victim's family. And nor are people who live across the street as afraid of saying something really stupid, because maybe they're more educated about what the crime is.
Now, you said earlier that it was only after writing the beginning of your novel, The Lovely Bones, that you decided to go back and write a memoir about your rape. And you said it was because you wanted to, like, tell your own story so that your own story wasn't superimposed on your character's story. I'm interested in how your memory functioned of the incident, because, you know, when after something that's about as traumatic as it gets happens to you, on the one hand, you really want to forget it so that it's not obsessing you and haunting you all the time. On the other hand, I suppose in a lot of ways you don't want to lose the memories that have been recorded so that you can continue to comprehend the experience. So did you find that you had, like, vivid memories of it, vivid enough to write an almost journalistic account of it? Or did you have to work to regain memories that you had tried to forget?
I would say my memory for the rape itself and the incidents surrounding the rape, like the trial, was better 5 to 7 years after the actual event, even up to 10, than it was in the first 3 or 4 years afterwards. You know, I very directly went into therapy right after the rape, all miserable experiences. And then I didn't do anything like that for about the next 10 years. And I found a lovely therapist who had the, you know, uniqueness of being free in New York and worked with her. But one of the things that was the funniest thing for me is that I'd written an article for the New York Times Sunday Magazine about rape and had been quoted in a book called Trauma and Recovery, which is an excellent book. And I bought it because I'd been such a miserable failure as a writer in my 20s that it was one of the few, like, places I had appeared in print. And on the subway home with the book, I realized that I was quoted in the first half, which was called Trauma, instead of the second half, which was called Recovery. And that strangely inspired me to read the whole book. And by the time I got to the end of the book, I realized that I had post-traumatic stress disorder and went from there. So only after, I'd say, a full 10 years away from the rape was I able to face the rape and deal with the clear memories of it. Luckily, one of the things I did right after the rape, because I was a kind of a, you know, morbid poetic kid, was write verbatim accounts of exactly what had happened to me physically and what the light had been like and things like that in a journal of mine.
What'd you do with the journal? Did you lock it up and put it away?
It was in my parents' basement the whole time I lived in New York. So I, you know, that's when you just love your parents for having a waterlogged, messy basement.
So the book was, the journal was still readable?
Yeah, the journal was readable, yeah.
And what was the experience of opening up the journal after a period of years had elapsed and reading it in the voice that you had a few years ago, reading the description?
I would say it was mind-blowing for a couple of reasons, and not the least of which was to realize what I had actually experienced. Because I think while you're going through it, you just, especially if you have the chance of going through a trial, which I did, you need to keep your eye on the ball. You need to be focused. You can't really drift off into maximum pain. So to go back and look at the accounts of what was actually happening, you know, I have to say, I just thought, like, hey, kid, you did okay.
My guest is Alice Siebold, author of the new novel, The Lovely Bones. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alice Sebold, author of the new novel The Lovely Bones. It's the story of a 14-year-old girl who was raped and murdered, then goes to heaven, where she observes her family try to carry on without her. Sebold is also the author of a 1999 memoir about being raped called Lucky. You were already interested in writing when you were raped. You were a freshman in college. Later in college, you were studying with the poet Tess Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the assignments she gave you after she realized about this trauma in your life was to write a poem that started, "If They Caught You."
Right.
I could see you responding one of two ways to that. One way to go, "Oh, give me a break," and the other to actually write a great poem. tell us what your response was to that.
I think with Tess, who was one of those teachers, I mean, I have taught and I have had wonderful teachers, and I believe that atmosphere, particularly for those students who are going through anything traumatic, can be an incredible atmosphere. And Tess did not shy away from dealing with a student who I'm sure a lot of people just thought, like, eek, keep her away from me. She might explode on me. She forced my hand on that. I had written a vague kind of poem about rape. We had a discussion in her office. She asked me if it were based on anything that had actually happened to me in my life. I told her, and then she suggested that. I admired her greatly as a poet. She was an extremely empathetic teacher. And out of that, I decided, okay, she's forcing me to do something. It feels a little weird, but it was a great thing to do. So, and they caught him a week later. So who knows? There was a little magic in that assignment.
People often wonder if writing is therapeutic. If you're writing about a trauma, does that help the pain of the trauma recede? I mean, Susie in the novel says something about, I forget exactly what she says, but it's something like every time she tells her story, like a drop of the pain goes away.
Right.
But as a writer yourself who's written about your own trauma and then written a mm-hmm. fictionalized version of a similar trauma, is writing therapeutic or do you think that that's really the wrong way to approach it anyways?
My feeling, and it's pretty, rigorous, is that therapy is for therapy, and that writing can be therapeutic, but therapeutic writing should not be published. My job as a writer is to go through the therapy myself, and if I manage to get through it and I feel I have something to share from that, to share it with my audience or my readers, but I don't write novels and seek to have them published so that I can get therapy from having written them. That's really the responsibility of an individual to do outside the context of their published work.
Before you wrote your memoir, when you went back and reread the journal that you'd written shortly after the attack, what was that writing like compared to the writing in the actual book?
Pretty horrible. If it's judged from a was it worthy ever of being published? No. It was extremely staccato, very direct. What I would say is it's like somebody taking a few moments out of being in the middle of the storm just to jot down the temperature, the angle of the wind, things like that. So it was all very factual, flat, uninflected writing, which just told the facts of what was happening.
And what did you want to do to it for publication?
I didn't want to do, I mean, I never used that as a draft of anything. Basically, I went back and read it, and it brought me back to the time. And what I would say is that it was a way of waking up my memory, just as when you walk down the street and you smell a certain smell, it might bring you back to the state fair when you were four or something. It had that same kind of, to evoke the memories, not to stand in for them.
Writers usually have to have some kind of empathy and understanding of each of their characters, the good guys and the bad guys. Do you feel like in your novel you had to have empathy for the rapist, who's a man from the neighborhood? He's a man that the family knows.
Definitely. In my own personal belief, you can't write a good character unless you have both compassion and respect for them. So Mr. Harvey, who is the killer in the book, yes, I have great compassion for him. There are moments where he attempts to try to do things other than what his driver's instinct is telling him to do, by counting things obsessively or building things. So he resists up until the point where he's no longer able to resist. And, you know, that is, you can have compassion without forgiveness. And I think that's what I would say.
Were you able to find that kind of compassion for the man who raped you?
I would say eventually, certainly not immediately. But, you know, we're all born into this world in very different ways, and we have different experiences of it. And I don't know a lot about him, but some of the things I do know led me to feel compassion for him. There are also many people who had much more worse circumstances than he did that have managed not to go out and rape people. But that doesn't mean you can't have compassion for them. I don't forgive him, but, you know, he's a human being. You have to move on. You know, it's just as simple as that. And so you find a way to move on. And having compassion for people just in general is a good way to live in life.
Well, Alice Siebold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Alice Siebold is the author of the new novel, The Lovely Bones. She's also the author of a 1999 memoir called Lucky. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Al Banks. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Bethany Klein. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Tony Shalhoub, the star of Monk, a new cable series about an obsessive-compulsive detective. We'll also meet the writer Andy Breckman. And we'll talk with actress Catherine Keener and director Nicole Holofcener about their new movie comedy, Lovely and Amazing, about a mother, three daughters, and their insecurities about their looks. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.